From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear this show at KCRW.com. My guest, writer-director Ralph Seaman, has made a film, Gangster's Paradise, that is a film that is both, I think, documentary-like and folkloric. A literal film noir, I guess, that's a look at the life of a major criminal in South Africa. Ralph, first of all, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me, Elvis.
If you can do me a favor and tell the audience what the film's about.
Jerusalem, A Gangster's Paradise, it's really a crime saga set in South Africa in the post-apartheid years. There had been this crime explosion, which started just before the end of apartheid and has really gone on until the modern day. I'd sort of been fascinated to try and find out what the roots of that were, where this explosion came from and what was really behind it. And I'd come across a story of a syndicate really, who were stealing high-rise buildings in downtown Johannesburg. And at that point, I knew I really had a story. It was big and it was bold, and it really seemed to encapsulate a lot of what it was about.
That title, though, Jerusalem, and one of the mentor to Lucky is Nazareth. There's certainly a lot of kind of Old Testament biblical references in this crime story. Mm.
You know, it's set in the period immediately after apartheid, and it is really a time of hope. It is a time, at the very beginning of the film, there's some footage I'd shot back in 94, where you really get the joyousness. And the idea that South Africa post-apartheid was a kind of a new Jerusalem, it was a new beginning, it was a new kind of a promised land. You know, I think you look at some of those vistas in the films and, Johannesburg's on this high plateau. It's 6,500 feet above sea level. And Hillbrow, where most of the film is set, is really the highest point. And you see these spires and the light, and it really does have this feeling of a kind of a shining city on a hill.
Yeah, and all the religious connotations of that. And it really is this, in this way, kind of this earthly corruption of heaven, isn't it?
It was also very much based on that hymn, Jerusalem. And I heard it everywhere I went in Johannesburg. There's ladies having church services in empty fields and plots of land and by rivers. And, you know, it seemed to really speak to what the film was about.
I was asking before we got started, because I said in the introduction that the film feels both to me folkloric and documentary-like. And the film that seemed like the most obvious touchstone, and you said nobody mentions to you before,
nobody's mentioned it,
is The Harder They Come.
Yeah. I sort of loved that. It was, you know, set in Jamaica. It had a very real feel. It was very strong on the music.
As your film is.
As mine is. It really got into a slice of that culture. Ivan's got one way out, and that's music. And, you know, this is his one chance to make it, you know, his shot from oblivion. And even that gets stolen from him. Even that dream is not something he can really follow through on. And much like Lucky, he becomes disillusioned and spirals into, you know, into heavier and heavier crimes.
Ivan and How They Come, like Lucky in your film, are both guys who want the best.
Yeah. Lucky's a guy who always wants to do the right thing. You know, he wants to go to college. He wants to get an education.
He wants to look like a businessman. He wants to be taken seriously.
Yes, he wants to be taken seriously. And he wants all the things he's dreamed of. He wants all the things that have promised him. But I think, as do a lot of the characters in the film, you know, if you look at the arch gangster Nazareth, you know, he also feels that he was promised certain things. You know, he was a guerrilla who'd fought. He'd been trained in Moscow, and he'd come back to find that, you know, the top brass of the ANC and guys who hadn't actually gone into exile were now filling all the top jobs. And the soldiers who were coming back, they were kind of forgotten. And to him, it's, where's my Victory Day parade? When do we march down the streets of Pretoria? We were promised a house in the suburbs. We were promised a nice car. I want it, and I want it now.
It's The Treatment. My guest is the director and writer of the film, Gangster's Paradise, Ralph Seaman. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. But I just find myself thinking so much about The Harder They Come, if only because it's about what sort of capitalism unchecked or corrupted capitalism can lead to.
Yes. It was one of the things in Jerusalem was that the center of Johannesburg had really become this kind of a Wild West.
Which it still is, by the way.
It still is, absolutely. You know, to the point that, you know, when we were filming there, we would hear gunshots regularly during the day. And, you know, there'd be police driving around raiding buildings. And sometimes we'd all grab our cameras and follow them. But it really, it was a Wild West. And it's not about what you own, but it's about how you can hold on to it. You know, and having the title deeds to a piece of property or, you know, saying I'm the owner.
Which is completely meaningless.
It's meaningless, you know, unless you can back that up with the muscle and you know, you can show that you'll do what it takes to keep it.
One of the things that occurred to me about being in Johannesburg, where I was a few years ago, is that everything is like turf, either figuratively or literally. And that's so much a part of what this movie is, too. I mean, you're talking about what it meant to Nazareth. This is this thing he wanted, this having this acknowledgement that he had given so much of his life and was trained to give his life for this cause, and not getting that acknowledgement when he returned and having nothing to come back to. And Lucky, on the other hand, not having that same kind of training or shaping, but still wanting something.
The character was based on a real-life guy called Stephen Kumalo, who had come across, who'd been hijacking buildings in downtown Johannesburg. He'd taken over, I don't know how many, 20, 30, 40 of these high-rise blocks. And he'd done it with a mixture of stealth and cunning. He had lawyers. They would intimidate people. And I'd come across him because he tried to take over a building that was managed by someone I know in downtown Johannesburg. And this was a building that was empty from the ground floor up. And when he'd come to do it, he'd gone to the shops and he'd given them fake conveyancing papers made out in the name of one of the top law firms in Johannesburg. He'd given them his bank account details because he wanted to be paid by direct debit. He didn't want cash because he didn't want to get robbed. He'd given them his cell phone number and I'd phoned up his card, the number on the card, and I'd spoken to him. And he asked me what I was doing. I said it was a film about crime in inner city Johannesburg. And his immediate response is, but why me, you know? But I'd convinced him to meet me, and he spoke.
How much of that was disingenuousness, and how much of that was wanting to see how far you wanted to go? What do you think?
I think he was just interested. I think he was kind of fascinated by it. And when I'd originally gone to meet him, he'd sent his bodyguard to pretend to be him to see that I was who I said I was, and that I wasn't followed, and I wasn't a cop, or I wasn't someone putting a hit on him. But when I met him, I really took the character of Lucky for him, because he couched everything he said in the language of the struggle. He talked about land, he talked about freedom, he talked about how the government had failed this promise to give housing to the people, and how he was following through with it, and how he was actually had been given a nod and a wink to go ahead and do this land redistribution, as he put it, through the back door. And he also talked to me about his troubles. He said that what had happened was that he'd come in and he'd taken these properties from white slum landlords, and, you know, he'd created, you know, living spaces for black people outside of the townships, and now people in the government and people within the Johannesburg municipality were making moves on his buildings themselves, using the police, using the Red Ants, and trying to kick him out because the property market had come up and it had become quite valuable. And he feared for his life. Later I heard that he had been actually killed by a rival gang in Hillbrow. I mean, he went by the nickname, they called him the Hitler of Hillbrow. There were other people calling themselves the same name. There was a guy called Cesar Ahunsvi in Zimbabwe, was head of the war veterans, and Cesar Ahunsvi's nom de guerre was Hitler Ahunsvi. And he was taking land away from white farmers and giving it to poor black peasants, black war veterans. And he was seen as a hero, and as such, Kumalo was seen as a hero in Hillbrow, who was, you know, this Robin Hood type character. But as far as I know, yeah, he was murdered.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to the writer-director of the film Gangster's Paradise, Ralph Zeman. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com, because one of the things I thought when I heard the character's name is that it's ironic, but he doesn't live his life based on luck. His life is all about being territorial and being even, and I love this, incredibly predatory in this conversation with people. Every conversation is about sizing somebody up.
Yes.
Because I wanted you to talk to me about finding the actor. Every time you talk to somebody, it's about probing that person for weakness in conversation.
I think all the actors seem to know the characters really well. I didn't really have to direct them that much. It really was, you know, these were guys they'd grown up with in the townships. The actors knew the characters better than I did. We'd looked at absolutely everybody. And, you know, from guys like Jeffrey Sekela, who played Nazareth, who'd done more or less nothing before, to Rapulana Simbiwe, who plays the older Lucky, and Rapulana was a huge soap opera star in South Africa. So it was really a mixture. I mean, there were kids who just, the young Zakes was a kid we'd found in the township. Our wardrobe supervisor had gone in to photograph kids who were dressed really well to see what they were wearing, and so she could base her wardrobe. And she was showing me the photos, and I go, "Who's this kid?" And she goes, "You know, he was this really smart, good-looking, like young Tsotsi, young street thug, and he let me take his picture." And I said, "Get him to come in for a casting." He'd come along at the same time as Jephtha Mabola, who played the young Lucky, and there was a really uncanny resemblance between the older and younger Lucky, which was just, it was just fortuitous for us. But they'd come along and they'd sparked off each other and they'd played it really well. And, you know, he was so great on set. He was a total method actor. He got into it. He'd never been on a film set. He'd never, you know, hardly been out of Soweto. And at one point I'd said to him, "You know, when you saw Natalie first time and she came along with the camera to take a picture, what were you thinking?" And he said he was trying to decide whether he should steal her camera or whether he should let her take the picture. And I said, "Aren't you glad you didn't steal the camera?" And he looked at me with this very serious look on his face and he went, "Mm-hmm," you know, so.
Well, as you're talking about this, one of the things that I like about the movie is it seems like you're trying to create a new visual language in it, something that's kind of between conventional master shot film and documentary filmmaking.
The cameraman who shot it for me, Nicholas Hoffmeyer, is like one of my oldest friends. He's a docu cameraman. He'd never shot any drama before. But he'd always go off and shoot these docus, and they always looked so amazing. And I'd be on these films, you know, making a film for $6, $10 million. And look, I say, "Your docu that cost $50,000 had like better shots than anything." And it was just this ability to see the moment and take it. And we decided to go with that. We decided to shoot the film mostly on Super 16, mostly on handheld cameras, albeit we went multi-camera, but we decided we were going to shoot everything as we found it. Because we were shooting in these buildings and they were 6 or 10 floors up and there were no elevators, there was often no electricity unless you ran it up, we'd either go with natural light, we'd carry up the minimum equipment we could because it gets heavy after about 2 or 3 stories. We didn't lock off the background. We got actors and extras to bring their own clothes. We let the traffic go in the background. If we were using extras, we'd pick them from where we were, from the same building, from the same street. And we'd say, "Bring your own clothes." So it really, we did it as naturalistically as we possibly can. No one had shot a feature film in Hillbrow for many, many years. It was generally considered to be, you know, completely lawless and a no-go area. Although I found the reality of Hillbrow to be a little bit different from that. And even the police in Hillbrow had said, "Don't go, don't shoot there. If you do, you get in trouble, don't call us, we won't come." But, you know, we'd gone ahead and it was different. We did become part of the community. Our first day shooting in Hillbrow was, ironically, was a scene we decided to go in and make an impression. And it's a scene where the helicopter comes to raid the building.
Oh,
and that was kind of amazing because people were, it was very intimidating. And it's exactly how the police stage a raid. It's a helicopter from on top, guys running in from the ground. And I always wondered why they used a helicopter because getting guys down the rope was somewhat clumsy. But you realize it's the noise. It's a concussion. It's this incredible oppressiveness of it. And it scares the living daylights out of people. And what happened was there were guys with stalls on the side of the road which were just overturning them and running. There were people throwing drugs out the window. There was the Hillbrow police who arrived in big numbers to see which building was being raided and what was going on. Even weeks later, people would say, "Did you hear about that building that got raided, and do you know who they were after?"
We're going to take a break. My guest is Ralph Zeman. His film, as writer-director, the new film is Gangster's Paradise. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. I'm talking to the director of the fascinating new South African crime film, Gangster's Paradise, Ralph Seaman. Just hearing you talk about this, it feels like you're finding the film as you're going along.
It was about looking down the street and saying, isn't that amazing? Or at one point in the film, there were police busting buildings across the road from us. And you see it, they're all in their flak jackets in these armored trucks like something in out of Iraq. And I said, scrap whatever we're doing. Everyone grab cameras and run. And we did. And we started following them around. And we got this amazing, you know, big vista of, you know, I don't know, 100 police raiding buildings and kicking in doors, and it was great, and they were very unhappy about us being there and shooting them. And at one point, this burly cop said to me, "Who said you can film here?" I said, "Well, I'm not allowed to." He said, "Who said you can film here?" And I just took a page out of Lucky's book and I said, "It's my democratic right, you know," and regretted it immediately.
You know, Ralph, you were saying before the break though that you found the reality of Hillborough was very different than what you expected it to be.
The reality was very different. I found that, say, places like downtown Johannesburg were much worse. And what I realized about Hillborough when we shot there, firstly, it was a community. People in Hillborough would go to work at 8 in the morning. They'd come back at 6 at night. They'd lock themselves in. And that would be it. It was also the domain of drug dealers. And a lot of kids coming in from the northern suburbs to buy predominantly cocaine would come into Hillborough, and the drug dealers didn't want to see them being robbed on their way in or their way out. So the dealers controlled the streets.
Now, you're talking about this. If anybody knows anything about African film, I have to ask you if you got the ultimate compliment, which is to have your film pirated. For those listening who don't know, the way much of African film works is that if a film is a hit, 2 weeks after it's out, it's immediately available in a pirated version.
It was, and we tried to, like, firstly, the film played in cinemas for 6 months. We put it out on DVD while it was still in the theaters. And what we did was we held off on the DVD until the first pirated copies showed up on the streets of Johannesburg. You'd be driving down the street in Johannesburg and there were guys trying to sell you your own film, you know, at the traffic lights, you know. So we'd even at one point looked at trying to use this pirating network as a way of distributing it.
Oh.
And we'd met with some Nigerian and Pakistani guys who ran the whole pirating thing. But they kind of handled themselves much like a lot of film distributors I've talked to. They had the lingo and
And they were willing to steal money from
you. They were willing to take the film and give us very little or nothing.
Sounds like the movie business to me. Yeah. It's their democratic right to steal from you.
It is.
I find myself thinking about so many of the music videos you've done, which are very romantic in a number of ways, except for Epic by Faith No More, which is kind of combative and in this weird way kind of sort of folkloric and reminds me a lot of stuff that you do in Gangster's Paradise.
Oh, really? Yeah, no. I'd always thought of it as being very different. I think the thing in music videos, it was all about trying to make it look nice, trying to make the moment look good, whereas I think in a film, you want to make the moment look as good as possible, but you want to do it within the context of telling a story.
And so many of the things you've done, like even the Ozzy Osbourne stuff and those pieces, were presentational. I just sort of thought, with Epic, because that really sticks out to me as something where you're building a mythos around Faith No More, and you're using this film as a way to build this kind of mythology around Lucky too.
Yeah, it was a mythology. It's true, and the film was a mythology, and it really did resonate. You know, I mean, because even while we were shooting it,
because seems to be a country hungry for myth still.
It is a country hungry, and people said to me when the film came out, like, finally, there's a movie for us. Finally, there's a film about our lives. Finally, there's a film that we can relate to. You know, that's about us. And I think, you know, that was kind of why we wound up being so pirated and why we had such an amazing saturation in South Africa, because it really had to be, you know, close to 100% to the point where, you know, Raps Rapulana, who played the lead character, if he walks down the street in Johannesburg or anywhere in South Africa, people will yell, "Lucky, lucky, lucky," out of buildings across the road. You know, it's become him, and he's done other films since it. But for the moment, he's called Lucky, and, you know, people just relate to him as the character.
It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest is writer-director Ralph Seaman. His new film is Gangster's Paradise. So much of the music has this kind of feel like it's coming out of the earth in the same way that Lucky feels like he grew. He's like almost a this kind of natural perversion of the laws of South Africa. And the music, though, has that kind of thing that it feels like it's kind of naturally flowing from places. And I wonder how you put so much source music together with the actual soundtrack.
You know, I would find source music wherever we went, and we didn't have a music supervisor, and really most of it came from me or Alan Lazar, who is the composer, who's also South African and loves the music as much as I do. A lot of it was African gospel, the Jerusalem, the hymns that you hear, and there would be church services everywhere where you'd be shooting time-lapse in Hillbrow, you'd hear these songs wafting up between the buildings, and there'd be these church services on top of mine dumps, and I'd kind of try and write down the words and try and sing them to people in my very tone-deaf way later so I could find out exactly what they were, you know? It was music that filtered out of the streets, and It is like that in Hillbrow, where if someone's playing music, they'll turn it up loud. So they want to share it with their neighbors. It's not kind of offensive in the way it is in Western countries where you have loud music. Your neighbor, it's actually kind of, and you'd always have this music of 100 different stereos coming at you and wafting in and out. And, you know, the noise of the traffic and people honking their horns and people shouting and people singing on the street. The noise is very much a part of the texture and the fabric. You close your eyes and you know you're in Johannesburg. You know you're in an African city. I was constantly finding bits of music and sourcing them and, you know, sending them to Alan and trying to figure out ways to get them in. So it was everything from Brenda Fassie, who was like the South African Madonna, to hip-hop, to classic Soul Brothers from the 50s and 60s. And it was about as eclectic a mix as we could find.
I was going to ask you a question about doing music videos because, as I was saying, so many of those are kind of presentational, putting the artist in the center of the frame, making sure that they were as out front as the song itself was, and this movie feels almost like a reaction of having to have done things that felt inorganic to you.
Yeah, you know, I think I hated doing music videos for a very long time. I'd fallen into it in the early 80s in England when I'd moved from South Africa, and I didn't have papers to work there, and it was the only part of the film industry which was deregulated, where you didn't have to be part of a union, and that was kind of how I came to it. I think I loved it at first, and after a while, it was just, it really oppressed me. You know, I wanted to be able to tell stories, and I found it inorganic. I think the way you describe it's really good. I do like the freedom of making a film. I do like the freedom of not having to go for the instant gratification, you know, at every stage of the way. I think it is a training ground. I don't know what I took out of it. I don't think about it much when I make a film.
You know? I would say the framing, and I mean this, the way you frame so much of the action in Gangster's Paradise, just kind of panning around and finding something.
Yes.
Just being able to do that and having your eyes and ears be open in a way that is a luxury you didn't often have if you're trying to service an artist in a music video.
I think the problem with the music video is your boss is standing in front of the camera, you know, and you want to be able to tell the person on the other side of the camera what to do, but you want to also not have to tell them what to do. And that was kind of the beauty of it. It's like, okay, I'm the boss, but you're doing such a good job, I'm just going to like let you go with this, you know? Whereas with a music video, you always had the sense of trying to please people. And you had the sense of working for numerous masters, be it the artist who was in front of the camera, the record company, the management company, the record company in England, the record company in Australia. And it would just, there would be these very difficult political maneuvers, you know, which I think really like drained the life out of you.
Because what you're looking for in this movie, because we think we're going to get one thing when it starts with a flashback, and it becomes a very different kind of story altogether. I mean, it's suddenly teeming with life after we move from the framing device at the very beginning. And that framing device is almost the kind of thing you would see at the beginning of a music video. And it's like you're using this as a way to reject these things you used to have to do and just sort of answer, no, this is not what I want from
this
a
film. This is not what I want. It's true. I mean, and I think the framing device gave us some freedom to see the character one way and then actually realize as the story progresses that it was really something very different. That
the way he thinks he sees himself.
Yes.
It starts from being a really subjective movie to becoming objective.
Right. Yes, it does. And you can just step back and you can get a feeling for where he is and who he was and how he came from and how the sweet kid becomes this gangster in Johannesburg, and how, you know, through his, like, I guess, poor life choices, but also through him taking an easy option at times when he should perhaps try harder, but maybe he could have tried harder and he still wouldn't have gotten anywhere with it. So I felt like you wanted to see him at his worst, and that was at the very beginning of the film.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to the writer-director of the film Gangster's Paradise, Ralph Seaman. I was wondering, are there different versions of the film that played in different countries? I mean,
it played with different names.
That's what I was wondering, because I wonder if the name Jerusalem caused some outcry in the religious community in South Africa.
It did, but the film actually caused even bigger outcry in political circles in South Africa. We did have a lot of the churches very angry about, you know, Nazareth, Jerusalem, this kind of, you know, the music that we used, which was church music, but also there was an outcry. But then, you know, we had the Veterans Association and various people at the Department of Arts and Culture really vilifying the film for showing the struggle and for showing what they called heroes of the struggle in a bad light, and for showing perhaps the government in a bad light, for having failed, you know, to live up to its promises.
Basically, they didn't want to take responsibility because the film is pretty honest and unblinking about this world it shows, about how could have been a good thing.
How did it happen that like 15 years after the end of apartheid, that the rich had become richer, the poor had become poorer, you know, the middle class have been stamped on, and these inner cities had become no-go areas of crime lords and drugs and violence. And you see what the buildings look like, and it's kind of like, you know, you've got a 15-story building which was designed for, say, 5,000 people, and there's 20,000 people living in it. The plumbing doesn't work. There's no electricity. There's no elevators. You carry your water up 10 flights of stairs. And, you know, some of them have no sewage, and that means that the sewage goes off the balcony and into the streets. And, you know, that was the reality of inner city Johannesburg, and people were very angry. And the film was made before the xenophobic outbursts, and was also made before Jacob Zuma came in as president. And an American had said to me that this is actually the first film of the Zuma generation, that it was the first post-apartheid film that was post the Mbeki Mandela generation. And that's why we'd found this incredible audience in South Africa. And I think that's perhaps why they'd been as upset about it as they were.
It's this thing I was saying to you earlier, though, that this hunger for mythology, and this is an attempt to create this kind of official, clean mythology in that South Africa before Zuma, and you're showing that there's a mythology growing out of the streets that can't be really contained or controlled in the way that they want.
No, absolutely. It was a street mythology, and it was something that was apparent even as we were making it. People were coming at us, and people who'd been watching a scene and said, finally, you're making a film for us. It's in our language. It's our characters. It's people we know. You know, everybody knows, everyone who lives in Soweto or in Hillbrow knows a Lucky Kuneni. Everyone who lives in Hillbrow or Soweto or Alex knows a Nazareth and Bolelo. And that it did speak in a way, and it was really of the moment.
We're out of time. Ralph, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for doing this.
Great.
My guest is writer-director Ralph Seaman. His new film as writer-director is the film Gangster's Paradise. A recording engineer at KCRW in Santa Monica is Mario Diaz. Bob Carlson is the editor. If you have any comments or questions, and I hope you do, please go to kcrw.com/thetreatment. Gemma Dempsey's producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.